Okay. Okay. Great gratitude for your life in Sangha. One question. When breath is my object, it can become quickly pleasurable. First foundation moved to second. Does that matter? And if it becomes very sensual, is that akusala? Yeah, it doesn't really matter in the sense that, I think any of the 16 steps are fair game. And but then also, you know, I think it, there's it's an interesting perspective in the sense of having skipped from, skip the bit on, you start just starting to pay attention to the breath, and it becomes pleasurable. There isn't a sufficient foundation of bringing the awareness into the body and having calm the body. So then it goes to, if it goes to sensuality. Because, I mean, there's pleasure is fine, is good, but then, of course, once it becomes, drifts into sensuality, then you're, especially in the terms of feeling, on that the second foundation, then it's moving from the mental formations, the citta sankhara, are turning into a hindrance, because it's not going to settle. So that calming of the bodily formation is very important. And similarly, which is part of the, which one can also do in the second foundation, because there's experiencing the citta sankhara, I breathe in, experiencing the citta sankhara, I breathe out, calming the citta sankhara, I breathe in, calming the citta sankhara, I breathe out. So the calming of those mental formations should also settle the tendency to it gravitating to the sensuality, because that keeps the mind stirred up and doesn't allow it to really settle and become clear. Okay, thank you so much for offering these wonderful teachings and also bringing so much joy and lightheartedness to evening Q&A sessions. As we prepare to break the silence, could you please remind us general guidelines for right speech? Think of one little guideline is really helpful. Is say a closed mouth gathers no foot. Mindfulness ahead of time is really helpful. especially after 10 days of restraint, and it starts to burst out all over, and that conscious attention to not just following the impulse. I think that's a really helpful guideline, because, I mean, you know, in reality, you already know what's appropriate, what's useful. But oftentimes, it's the in the excitement of the moment, then impulses just sort of start flowing out. So that extra little extra restraint is really helpful. So I'm getting all sorts of dedications here for the evening chanting. In your opinion, what should a person consider when faced with a decision? For example, what to do next? What if, ... That person can't decide. Thanks for everything. I think one of the things is, as one's facing a decision, can't quite decide, paying attention to the kind of wavering and agitation that one feels, rather than trying to figure out too much the details. Because mostly the details you've sort of chewed it over so many times, it's turned into kind of mush already. So that the coming back and really trying to calm the calm the body, calm the mind, get a place of feeling settled, and then see what comes up from a place of being settled, and you usually have a bit of clarity around that, and on a certain level, there comes a point where sometimes you have to just do something. It's okay to make mistakes as well. I mean, oftentimes, some of the decisions that we agonize over are decisions between two wholesome things, and there isn't really a way to clearly foresee how that's going to turn out, and all you can do is just go with what just seems top of the list at the moment. If it's a decision between one wholesome thing and one unwholesome thing, then it's a no-brainer. But usually it's the the things that turn into a quandary are things where it's actually, say, a decision between two quite decent, good things, and then we try to figure out what's going to be the best, and then it gets complicated. So that then it's important to come back, calm oneself as best one can, and then in the end, all you can do is just trust and realize, okay, if it didn't work out, it's you can always start again, reconfigure the trajectory further on down the line. I mean, those are things, because we do end up oftentimes worrying and obsessing over some decisions that you can't really foresee the outcome. So you just have to commit to something and reflect on it with some care and consideration. Oh, great. Thank you, Charla, for the chanting lessons. Where is she? There she is. Yeah, very, very helpful. It actually, Charla put herself forward to do that, and I had totally forgotten now, because most years we do tend to give some kind of chanting instruction, or but it sort of slipped all of our minds. So Charla was there picking it up. Hey, dear Lumpa, thank you so much for your teachings, especially the ones around the elements. I've been experiencing several migraines a week for a long time now. Exploring the sensations using the elements has been very useful. I realize that I have been leaning toward annihilation this fall, and this retreat has helped me backtrack to the middle way with much gratitude. Especially in circumstances like that where there's some kind of pain, discomfort, difficulty, the body and the mind are kind of out of sorts, then contemplation on the elements is one in terms of being able to step back from the identification with the body, but then also sometimes putting attention on the perception of elements that helps to give a feeling of a balance and ease. So then that's oftentimes a helpful way of you know, giving some kind of relief or alleviating particular imbalances that we're experiencing, both mentally and physically. So it's an exploration that gets a bit more refined, but very, very helpful. Okay, please give instructions on the part of evening chanting when we acknowledge our faults to the Triple Gem. It seems a bit ritualistic to me and short for contemplation. Thank you. But I think one of the... Again, these are it's a devotional exercise. It's really important to put it in that context. When one... as a devotional exercise, when one lifts up something like Buddha Dhamma Sangha as an object of respect and gratitude, then one contemplates the principles underlying or what those refuges signify, in that sense of Buddha signifying awakening, wisdom, purity, compassion, Dhamma signifying truth, reality, Sangha signifying virtue, integrity, then those are... one is holding that up as a principle that we want to incline towards and encourage the heart towards, and that's an ideal, and the reality is there's always some kind of lapse of mindfulness, habits and conditioning kicking in, and there's those times when we really don't aren't able to hold that so steadily. So then, recollecting that this is a devotional exercise, then when we recollect Buddha Dhamma Sangha, then also recollecting any time when we have been unskillful or in actions of body, speech, or mind, then to renew our commitment to that kind of respect and gratitude. So it's a way of renewing, one kind of cleaning the slate and clearing it off, and then having that renewed commitment. And it's something that one does on a regular basis. Similar with the precepts, it isn't as well. The precepts are to be reflected on, cultivated, paid attention to, and then one keeps renewing and refreshing one's commitment to that. It isn't as if one sort of keeps a list of all the times that one's broken the precepts and then brings that up in order to flagellate oneself with, I did this and I did that. One brings it up and renews that commitment, clears the slate off. It's a fresh beginnings. These are skillful ways of helping us to have the energy and the focus to allow those qualities that really are a refuge for the heart, to allow them to really become clear and steady within us. Okay, I recall that the Buddha said, even if we carry our parents on our shoulder until the day we die, we still have not repaid their kindness. Please explain the Dharma ways to repay our parents' kindness. The Buddha says, establishing sort of stingy parents in generosity, unvirtuous parents in integrity, unwise parents in discernment and understanding. Those are the ways. It's more like being able to encourage parents to have a perspective that gives them tools in their life for creating goodness. And that's not so easy. And also sometimes it's for children to teach or to advise their parents, sometimes it doesn't go over so well. So that, I remember in Thailand, there's an idiom that usually teachers and parents will use of their children, especially around usually younger children, younger students. Wangai, songai, sort of that, easy to teach. And when I was living in Thailand, especially in my later years, when I had more contact with my parents, Thais oftentimes ask how your parents, are they supportive of you being a monk, and what's your relationship to your parents and things like that, because it's very important in Thai culture that. And I'd oftentimes say, well, my parents are easy to teach. It's sort of turning the idiom around, and it sounds very, a kind of shocking, actually, to say that. It's not how one uses the language, but it was quite true in the sense that my parents always. Supported me for my interest in ordination or interest in Buddhism, even when I was showing interest in Buddhism in at university, and my mother tried to find me a Buddha image. Of course, in those days, all there was the, kind of the fat Buddha. The intention was there. And then when I left to go travel, I left to go traveling. And it was right, I had Christmas with my family, and then I left right after that. And that was one of my Christmas presents, was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It had just come out, so that was. And then they came to visit me in Thailand once, and then they visited once in England for the opening of Amaravati. And then other than that, and I didn't go back to Canada for 16, 17 years, see the rest of my family. And I was invited to lead a retreat outside of Vancouver, a 10-day retreat. And my mother, my father, my sister were all on the retreat. My dad was the bell ringer in the morning. repaying that debt of gratitude to parents. Okay, we'll see what response we get. May we hear from all the monastics and Debbie what their primary meditation object is. Do they have a preference in walking, standing, or sitting meditation? If it's mindfulness of the breath, where in the body do they focus? Ajahn Krundamo.
Pastor.
There you go.
Do you go first? That's your meditation.
Ever since I was in Anagarika, my primary meditation object was Buddho, and I prefer walking meditation.
Primary meditation object has been the confused, muddled mind. And then when it's more diligent, the breath. And what was the other question?
Preference for walking, standing, or sitting?
Oh, actually, I've been really enjoying standing meditation lately. So, but it varies. So.
Breathing, breath meditation is my primary meditation object. I'm not always very good at it, but and I'd say walking and sitting kind of 50-50. And sometimes I'll stand, but I tend towards walking or sitting.
I use a wide variety of meditation objects, actually, depending on what's happening in any moment. So I can't say there's really a primary one. And good mix of walking and sitting.
That's it. At the monastery, all of the dwelling places have walking meditation paths that are specifically designated. They're cleared and they're flattened and they're so that walking meditation. That was one of the things that I always went from the beginning of Abhayagiri, or even before when I was living in Thailand, making sure that there's good walking paths at the dwelling places, so that there's kind of a it's like your walking meditation path is, you know, calling out, you come out and walk on me, you know. So that that's because walking, I think, is really important for that balance of the meditation. Okay, it looks like this next question is about walking meditation. Okay. In the walking meditations, as I focused more on the sensations of the feet, my mind settled and my senses, hearing, sight, smell, became more clear. Mindfulness and settledness, or unification of mind, seem to develop so differently in walking meditation. In terms of directing my attention in walking meditation, what is the difference between mindfulness and awareness? Can one have unification of mind without mindfulness? In walking, as the mind went on and on, underneath was the body and the breath pulling for attention. These are great ways of just paying attention to that process. And I think with, directing attention, they're really mindfulness, awareness, they're just different terms that we use. The unification of mind without mindfulness is certainly possible. It's not the unification of mind that one was maybe hoping for. You can be have great unification of mind over some desirable sense object, and you can really get the mind focused. Or some irritation, the mind can unify really effectively. But that's not really what the Buddha is encouraging. So that mindfulness is a primary characteristic of the unification process. And that's something like in meditation and in practice, as the mind becomes more settled, more peaceful, and a bit more settled, then it's important that that mindfulness is keeping pace with the settling, because that's when the mindfulness is not and alertness is not present, then the mind can come together, but then that's where it drops into dullness, or drops into some kind of drifting imagery or fantasy, so that the mindfulness is a really important quality that has to be implemented at all sort of stages along the way. Thank you so much for being so patient, compassionate in answering all the questions. Highly appreciated, and feel very fortunate to be on this retreat. Question: does keeping the first precept mean eating only vegetarian meals? Are there exceptions, like when there is no choice, etc.? A refined aspect of keeping that first precept is around eating, but then also especially us as monks, our that precept around harmlessness, non-harming, is very strong, very refined, but we rely on the generosity of others, and we don't really have choice, so that sometimes you just what is offered is can be offered that it can be meat sometimes, and it's not a breaking of the precept, it's a conscious choice that we can make to refrain from eating meat, but it doesn't mean that we've broken that precept. So there's a distinction between the act of of taking life, harming life. And then the, especially in terms of, in some circumstances and situations where one doesn't really have any control, so that one can feel confident that one's that precept is not being broken. Can you talk about denial? I realized on this retreat that things happen that I don't like in life, or treated badly, and I have a habit of not seeing it or minimizing it. One of the ways of expressing it in a familiar Dhamma way. It's a function of when speaking of the, say, like the root defilements of greed, hatred, delusion. Delusion is that quality that loves to moves to denial or comes up with an alternative explanation that is comfortable for one's defilements, but not actually in accord with reality. So that's a function of delusion, and that's why. That's one of the things that the Buddha said, that like of those three main roots of defilements, greed, hatred, delusion, greed has Um, usually not so bad consequences, but it's very difficult to eradicate or overcome. The anger can have very really bad consequences, but it's easier to overcome. Delusion has bad consequences and is hard to overcome. so it's like those aspects of delusion really need to be, we need to be checking and contemplating, reflecting, paying attention to, and it's also having good friendships of in Dhamma that we can get feedback, because the function of delusion is very powerful, and so that denial, I'd say, comes from that delusional quality. So that learning how to see things more clearly, see things in an appropriate way, and then reflecting on that aspect of suffering, of difficulty, of dis-ease, of discontent, complication, and seeing, okay, where'd that come from? Peeling around those layers of delusion. Okay, very nice. During a tough moment today, I had the thought, don't buy energy thought, the marketplace of the mind is selling. Mm-hmm. Don't buy every thought, the marketplace of the mind is selling. You're very good. Thank you for your sensitivity to us as a group and tuning the teachings to where we were at. Very helpful. Yeah, it's great. Don't buy every thought, the marketplace of the mind is selling. It's great. Especially this is Thanksgiving. Sort of there's a lot of marketplaces out there. Despite my mom's constant encouragement, I never learned patience. Now, as a parent, I'm teaching myself and my kids this skill. Can you offer practical tips for becoming more patient? It's just this. I have found so much benefit in the mindfulness of the body, and in the sense that not just as a intellectual analysis of the body, but paying attention to the energies in the body, paying attention to the feeling in the body, because it's the mind is so quick that we get pulled out really easily, and but when we're tuning into the body, one starts to feel that those kinds of energies and impulses and pulls and agitations and niggling uncertainties, and that sort of one feels it in the body, and sort of tuning in to places where we do feel, or where we tend to move quickly, or somewhere we impulsively moving, and then we go, oh, what was that about? And so getting an anchor in the sort of bodily presence, and getting comfortable, so that impulse and that impatience doesn't pull us too quickly. And we've got this solid anchor that is actually comfortable. And that's another aspect of it, in the sense of making things comfortable for yourself, because that's the so much of the movement of the mind and the movement in our life is we're moving to try to get away from something uncomfortable. And we're just trying to get out of it, moving away. And so then having an anchor of ease within ourselves, then there isn't that same kind of impulse or pull. It's not so strong. That gives enough space to actually exercise patience. Okay. It seems that when one is cultivating insight, one needs to distrust one's mind. But to develop stillness, there needs to be an element of trust. Does one hold both at the same time or alternate between them? Yeah, that's an interesting perspective in that sense of because looking at it in one way, that sense of that cultivation of insight is one does need to go past the apparent assumption of our experience and go behind. So there is a certain element of distrust or because the mind is always painting a picture that's comfortable for itself. So then to try to get underneath that layer. So there is a certain element of distrust. And certainly for that stillness and calm, then we really have to rely on trust, on that sense of trusting in our own, trusting in well-being, trusting in peace, trusting in the heart itself, that's what it really wants. So that they work together, and also I just add another layer to it. In terms of say relinquishing and letting go, releasing, then you have to come back to trust again. So there's calm, insight, release, and the nature of of insight or wisdom or that analysis, investigation, insight. Sometimes it just wants to keep investigating, and in the end you have to trust enough to just put it all down. Okay, dear Lumpo, thank you. Thank you for your teaching. Would you talk a little bit about sharing merit? Why? How? When? I think backtrack again. just mention again that the word merit comes from the Pali word punya. And punya being kind of wholesome action, and the Buddha sort of saying merit being another, or punya being another word for happiness, so that the natural result of wholesome or skillful action is happiness and well-being. That's its natural quality or tendency. So that in the actual doing of something that is skillful, beneficial, meritorious, that is punya, then being able to acknowledge it in that sense of being able, and the sharing of merit is one of its functions, is to be able to delight in the goodness that one has done. And that's a really important function of, say, sharing of merit, is to make one's own skillful actions conscious, so that it can be a source of happiness and well-being for us. And that's something that is oftentimes not well, say, understood, or but I think it's important to recognize, that when we share that sharing of merit, it's an opportunity to make it clear that something that we've done has been really, it's been wholesome, it's good, and we can delight in that goodness. And that's a many in a culture that has a certain amount of self-deprecation, self-abnegation, just delighting in something that good that one's done goes against the grain. It's not normal, but that's it's actually a wholesome part of creating a base of normal well-being in the human condition. And so that's certainly the why, is just this establishing a baseline of feeling good about yourself. And the how is, it's definitely it's a mental act, and that one bringing it to mind, allowing it to one's own heart to delight in that, and then to have the thought of, may whatever goodness that's done, may it be a benefit for others. And it can be specific, it can be defined, or it can be directed, or it can be more, kind of global in a sense, for all benefit, all sentient beings. There's ways that are traditional in terms of dedicating a merit, sometimes for the people who have been to the monastery, sometimes you'll see that where people have a transferring, a symbol for the transferring of merit or the dedicating of merit is using a vessel of water and then pouring it into another vessel. So that's a tangible thing that one can be doing, that symbolizes that sharing, that dedicating, that transferring of merit. It doesn't, I mean, it's primarily a mental act, but we need the props so that just by doing something that our mind can focus on, then we can sustain that intention and be able to formulate that intention of sharing a bit more concretely. And then after having, and it usually be that dedication will be during the, I mean, it can be any time, but oftentimes it's at the, say when there's a chanting of the meal blessing, chanting of the dedication chants that we do. One can do it at that time. And then once it's poured into another vessel, you're taking that vessel and then taking it out and putting it on a tree. So then you're keeping a cycle of goodness going. So that's also the when. Say after, I mean, if there's been something very specific that one has done, sort of really recollecting that, like oftentimes one, say people will do dedications of merit. Say they'll come to the monastery and make food offerings, meal offerings, or offerings of requisites in honor of family members that have passed away, or somebody who is ill or suffering in some way, and then you make a dedication, you make those offerings, and then at the blessing chant, then they're doing the dedication at that time. So it's a ceremony, it's a ritual, but it's primarily it's how it's held in the mind, but it's helpful to have those, the tools, the props. It focuses it a bit more clearly. Thank you for your teaching. The Dhamma has become a continuous education for me. Could you please speak about your experience encountering people with different abilities, such as autism, dyslexia, blind, deaf, etc., on the Dhamma path? With gratitude. Over the years had opportunity to sort of meet, speak, teach. People with these different difficulties, and unless, say, something like autism is really severe, then the mindfulness and mindfulness of the body is really very, very helpful. And it helps, it gives a grounding for them. Dyslexia, then it's... there's several of the monks in our community that are dyslexic, so they're using the training and the practice to help them. Blind, for several years in a row. I go back to Thailand every year, and when I go, I end up you know, pretty busy. And for several years in a row, I was invited by a Dhamma group that was run by a blind person. He had his own radio station and a Dhamma radio station. He was blind. He encouraged other people who were blind and to be practicing. So I met with their group, and then I've also taught at the School for the Blind in Bangkok, and that there's a large school with children. There'd be a whole almost a whole half day of events at the school. So then, yeah, the one that's more difficult is deaf, because you don't realize how much we rely on our hearing for really, getting a feel for the world around us. So sometimes, in terms of difficulties in communication, that's been, of course, here in America, and I think increasingly in Thailand now, then there's more signing learned, so that actually, I've noticed that in Thailand, you've got lots on television, you have a lot of channels that make Dhamma teachings available, and Dhamma talks, and there'll be in the corner there'll be somebody signing, so that's really something that, that's something probably within the last 10 or 15 years. So I think that's incredibly helpful. I haven't had my own experience of sometimes a bit, just not having the skill and knowledge of how to help. That's been so. We had at Wat Nanachat, I lived for many years at Wat Nanachat. He was deaf. He was a villager, lived nearby, and started coming to the monastery helping. And we called him Tommy. He drew close to the monastery for years and years. He really benefited by the proximity, but without some kind of special skill, say like signing, then it's hard to really to convey, I think. Although he obviously I think picked up a lot just by tuning in. There are these opportunities to include and encourage all sorts of people, mindfulness and the Buddhist teachings. It's all around suffering and the end of suffering, and everybody suffers. It's not one way or it's another. So. Okay, this is not a question, but it's nice. This is a quote from Dhammapada, it's Ajahn Munindo's rendition, verse 173. One who transforms old and heedless ways into fresh and wholesome acts brings light into the world like the moon freed from the clouds. Thank you for your generous teachings, Lumpo. Your example of strength in Dhamma shows well in your own disciples. May every heart find release from suffering and true happiness. This is a dedication of merit of meal offering, and using that as a dedication to and it's also something in the idiom that's used of dedication of merit is the it's just the idiom in Thai is the dedication of kusala of the wholesome, the good, dedication of the meritorious that's done, and spreading loving kindness. It's usually they're synonymous. It's a dedication of merit and spreading loving kindness. They're sort of the in the idiom of in Thai language. That's how it's kind of they're always together. Okay, this is not a question, but a expression. Ajahn, what I want to know is this. How on earth do people manage to live without the Dhamma, or with Dhamma in their heart, even if they don't call it such? Truly, I cannot imagine how I would survive. This week I've had to employ some heavy mindfulness excavators to do some deep work in the heart. Yet I also know that I have some amazing, awesome Kamma to be part of this Sangha. There are beautiful role models here, both ordained and not, walking the path of peace. I have found my spiritual home at Ubayagiri, and for this there is so much gratitude words cannot express. To Ajahn and to everyone. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very beautiful. Another dedication. Okay, that's it. Ta-da, it's a done deal. We got through all the questions. Okay.